from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bernie Sanders has cut a remarkable swath through this Democratic presidential primary season. He's said things that needed saying with a bluntness that seemed almost lost to American politics. He's built a powerful campaign of passionate supporters, challenged a long-presumed front runner. The next few days with South Carolina and Super Tuesday will say a lot about where his campaign goes. The debate among Democrats right now is intense. This hour, On Point, debating the potent challenger, Bernie Sanders. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Democrats, Republicans looking on, what do you see? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was Sanders in Greenville, South Carolina on Sunday. Exciting supporters there with his call for political revolution.
The only way we change America, it's not just electing a president. Obviously, I'm here to ask for your support. It is much more than that. It is to create a political revolution.
We will hear in just a moment from ardent Sanders supporter and labor activist Jonathan Tassini. Joining me first from Princeton, New Jersey, is Paul Starr. He's a professor of sociology, public affairs at Princeton, co-founder, co-editor of The American Prospect. His 2007 book, Freedom's Power, is a history of liberalism. We had thought he might be a Sanders supporter. Turns out he isn't. We wanted to know why. Paul Starr, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
So we were talking with James Fallows this week. We had read his big essay in The Atlantic, and he cites you talking about how gilded ages end. And little doubt, we're in what Mark Twain then and we might now call a gilded age when wealth is so concentrated. And he cites you saying that finally it depends on the ability of political power to control economic forces. The New Deal, for example, was about political power reasserting its preeminence, and quotes you saying behind the myriad of specific reforms of the New Deal was a common recognition, a collective revulsion against the privileges of great wealth allied with great power. You argued that the country is due for that kind of an adjustment again, and we thought that might mean you would support Bernie Sanders. Turns out you don't. Why not?
I don't, because there's a big difference between the progressive reforms enacted in the early 20th century under Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and the even more thoroughgoing reforms enacted under Franklin Roosevelt. Those reforms did in fact bring about the end of power of wealth that had previously controlled American politics in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. There were, I think, three elements that were crucial. There were important changes in taxes, the introduction of an income tax and the estate taxes, changes in the rules of politics controlling campaign finance, many other things, antitrust law and so forth. The United States did that without turning to socialism. Now, I think there's a big difference between liberalism and socialism, and I take Bernie Sanders at his word. He's a socialist. He wants a revolution. A lot of people seem to discount this. They don't really focus on it. They think, well, you know, maybe that's just a kind of rhetorical flourish. But I think if you look carefully at the Sanders program, it's very disturbing. I support a lot of the individual elements, but when you add them all up, when you add up all the taxes, there are 11 different tax increases that Sanders has called for in different proposals. He's up to tax levels that are higher than Sweden's or Denmark's. He is a kind of really old-fashioned socialist who pays very little attention to the practical consequences, the economic consequences of what he's doing. And I think the big difference is that liberals care about maintaining the incentives for a flourishing private economy.
We're going to hear in a moment from a very strong defender of Bernie Sanders. But let me put it to you, when this kind of critique comes to Senator Sanders, he says, "Look, don't be afraid. We've done this before. We had the New Deal." And then I pick you up and read you saying Sanders' portrayal of democratic socialism as nothing but the New Deal is a disingenuous sleight of hand that plays on foggy historical memory. What do you mean?
Franklin Roosevelt was not a socialist. Socialists ran against FDR, and there was, I think, a clear difference between the reforms that Roosevelt introduced, Social Security, regulatory programs that, in fact, were designed to curb the excesses of capitalism. In fact, they helped to save capitalism from excess. I think it's very different from a socialist program. And again, I think you have to look at the Sanders program in total, what it all adds up to. So one example that I give in that article that's in Politico has to do with the subject of capital gains taxes. So capital gains taxes affect the level of investment. They affect the level of innovation. Firms in Massachusetts or in Silicon Valley and many other places, they need investment in order to develop new technologies and so forth. We can't just be oblivious to the consequences. So he's got capital gains taxes rising up to 64% at the federal level. Then you have to add in state capital gains taxes, which average about 4%. And he's got a financial transactions tax on top of that. So altogether, we're talking about tax rates on capital gains of about 70%. Now, what are the tax rates on capital gains in Denmark and Sweden? In Denmark, highest in Europe, 42%. Sweden, 30%. He's talking about capital gains tax rates that have no comparison anywhere in the world. This is it's just irresponsible.
Okay. There's a beginning position on the table from Paul Starr of Princeton. Paul, please stand by there in New Jersey. With us right now from San Francisco is Jonathan Tessini. He's a labor organizer, political strategist, Bernie Sanders supporter. He is out around the country speaking on behalf of the Sanders campaign. He's author of The Essential Bernie Sanders and His Vision for America. You can link to his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Also to Paul Starr's piece he just cited in Politico and more. Jonathan Tessini, thank you very much for being with us today. Paul Starr says, look, these numbers don't add up, and this is not just the New Deal for 2016. This is something quite different and much more thoroughgoing.
Well, that's kind of rubbish. The numbers do add up, and I would start by sort of giving the context that the changes that happened in the early part of the 20th century. One of the most important things that was forgotten was this: there was a huge movement in the streets, both on the part of workers. Some of it was because there was agitation in the workplace. There were people who were trying to form unions. So this didn't just happen because of some, FDR waking up one day and saying, "Oh, gee, we should change the laws." It happened because of movements, and I think
he's not arguing that it just happened because FDR woke up one day. To be very clear, he's very, very tuned into the progressive movement, but he says what we ended up with out of that was not what Bernie Sanders is proposing.
What I was going to say before you jumped in there was that we are seeing something similar. And while history, it can be instructive, I think the levels of inequality and the kind of wage inequality that you're seeing now has awakened people. And frankly, having been an organizer now in the streets, recruiting people, building movements for the last 25, 30 years, I think what you're seeing and what Bernie has tapped into is a feeling that wage growth has not been going anywhere, that the inequality is at levels that we've not seen before. And what Bernie has put together, I think, is quite a reasonable plan to change that. So, for example, and paid for, and a very modest one. So let's look at the infrastructure plan that he has proposed.
Okay.
Rebuild America Act. He's proposing to spending $1 trillion to fix the country. Now, this isn't some radical proposal. It's actually exactly the number that's being proposed by the American Society of Civil Engineers, a pretty, pretty mainstream organization.
Right.
And he suggests paying for that in a particular way by making corporations pay taxes on all the profits they've shifted to the Cayman Islands. We know that there's been a lot of tax shifting to money being deposited in the Cayman Islands. That can raise about $100 billion a year. And I can go through every single one. Everything is paid for. And in a quite actually conservative, in my opinion, and modest way. Again, something like rebuilding the country. Same number that's being proposed by the American Society of Civil Engineers. So it's not radical at all. And I think that the people have responded to that in quite a very, very strong way. Now, I'd like to separate two things in the conversation. One is the economics of it and the numbers, which are supported by all sorts of institutions and analysis versus the political challenge. And I don't disagree, and I think Bernie has been very clear about it, and I think that's an interesting debate. How do you get these things enacted given the political climate? In other words, where you have Republicans controlling the Congress, that's a huge challenge. And I think that's, frankly, a very interesting question.
You know, Paul looks at, for example, capital gains, adds up 64% rate plus 4% state plus the financial transaction tax that Senator Sanders has in mind, says it comes up to 70% capital gains tax overall, higher than the social Democrats of Europe, and he's suggesting unsustainable.
Well, I don't agree. Let's look at the financial transactions tax, which has actually been looked at by pretty mainstream organizations, for example, the Urban Institute and Brookings Institution. So one of the things they said in a really fascinating report, and because Paul's not an economist and I'm not an economist, I actually go to people who actually look at the economics of it. So they in a study that they did, which was just about in June 2015, I'm reading for it if I can.
Yeah.
At the very least, the notion that an FTT is unworkable should be rejected. Most EU countries have or are planning to adopt FTTs.
Yeah, but Jonathan, he's not saying that. You're ducking my question. You're ducking my question. The 70% total. He's not saying you can't have a financial. No. It's the total I asked you about.
So I actually like a financial transaction tax, but it has to be at a reasonable level.
Good. Well, I think that the total does add up, and I don't think those are unreasonable numbers. If you take those as a whole, financial transactions, that capital gains, the increase in personal income taxes, I don't think that those are unreasonable, given the huge amount of wealth that's been accumulated by the very top 1%,
yep,
by the billionaires, in fact.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Democrats' debate over Bernie Sanders with a big supporter, a big critic, and all the issues on the table. Paul Starr is with us, professor of sociology, public affairs at Princeton University, co-founder, editor of The American Prospect. He's been writing a lot about how gilded ages end. He says we're in one. We need a reassertion of political over economic power in this country, as we saw earlier in the 20th century. More there from Politico as well. He is not supporting Bernie Sanders. Jonathan Tassini very much is, labor organizer and political strategist. He's been out on the road, expenses paid by the Sanders campaign, but he's not an employee of the campaign, talking up the Sanders message, the Sanders vision. You can join us in this hour. Are you looking at Sanders and thinking it adds up? It doesn't add up economically, politically. Sanders supporters, what do you make of Paul Starr's critique? Yes, we need a change, but this isn't it. Clinton supporters, what about Jonathan Tassini's warning, you know, a little change won't be enough? Jonathan Tassini says, wealth has accumulated for a long time. It's time to tap it. Bernie Sanders was channeling that in a CNN town hall on Tuesday.
Top one-tenth of 1% in America now own as much wealth as the bottom 90%. I think that that is wrong. So here it is, folks. You can like it or not. This is my view. We are going to ask profitable multinational corporations and the rich to start paying their fair share of taxes.
Paul Starr, it's a gilded age. The wealth has been stacked up to the skies. And Jonathan Tassini says, okay, these may be some significant bites, but that's what's called for here. And, hey, a trillion on infrastructure, that's what the American engineers are calling for.
We should have a big infrastructure building program. Look, in the piece that I wrote, How Gilded Ages End, I laid out a series of things that I think we should do to attack what I call tax privileges. Those are things like the carried interest loophole that enables hedge fund managers to pay tax rates that are lower than their secretaries. I think we need a comprehensive attack on offshore tax havens. We actually have legislation from 2010 that enables us to do more, but you have to do that actually through international means, in fact, this needs to be a top priority in foreign policy, in diplomacy, that we pursue means with other countries to control tax evasion that's eroding the fiscal capacity of governments all over the world. So I totally agree that we need more equitable and progressive taxes. I am disturbed, however, by the sheer magnitude of the increase. I mentioned capital gains. Actually, the tax rates on earnings, when you put the payroll taxes and income taxes that Sanders is calling for together are also – his rates are also higher than Sweden's and Denmark's. So this is just it's just a bad idea to take it this far. And I worry that he's discrediting the good ideas that progressives have.
Jonathan Tessini, it comes back to this issue of volume. Yes, there's enormous amassed wealth, and Paul Starr's a big critic of that. He's put the Gilded Age label right on it, but says this is this may tilt it too far the other way in response.
Oh, I'm sorry, that was to me.
Yes.
Well, look, we have this massive inequality, and the amount of wealth, as Bernie has quite articulated quite well, and which I think most people understand has happened, partly because they reflect that in their own lives, which is their wages are stagnant, and they see this huge amounts of wealth being concentrated at the top. Those tax rates that we're talking about for the very, very wealthy, not for the average person, are completely in line with the kind of inequality that we see. And the most amazing thing to me, Tom, is that
Jonathan, you're breaking up there. I'm sorry to say.
Something. This is a debate between people who want to think small and people who want to think big. And Bernie has been very clear that he wants to think big. And I'm sorry. Yeah, well, Bernie has been very clear that he wants to think big. And the debate really is between the people that want to do incrementalism and think very, very small versus Bernie, who sees the crisis at hand and wants to think big. And, you know, I'm always struck by, you know, if you went back to the time when John Kennedy said, we will reach the moon, or when LBJ said, let's create the great society, or when Martin Luther King gave the I Have a Dream speech, or even when people marched for marriage equality, all those people, if they had the naysayers sort of whispering in the ear, don't do that, this is too big, don't do that, we would never have made progress. We would never be the country that we had today. And part of that was because people had imagination. People said we should reach beyond what the current thinking is, the small thinking, and we should think big. And we have the second point I'm making on the economics of it, and this relates somewhat to the politics, we have plenty of money in this country. The question is a set of priorities. So, for example, we did not hesitate, and I don't put myself in this category, but Hillary Clinton did not hesitate to vote for the Iraq War, the George Bush Cheney Rumsfeld War, which spent $3 to $4 trillion of our money. All of a sudden, we're able to find that money to spend on these things. It's not a lack of money; it's a lack of imagination and the wrong set of priorities.
Paul Starr, this argument of thinking big versus incrementalism. This is a potent engine in the Sanders campaign. Many people, young especially, have responded to this. Okay, we got a problem. Let's think big to take it on. What do you say?
I'm in favor of thinking big, but I'm not in favor of thinking bad. And a lot of what Sanders is proposing is bad, is not good, is these tax rates, as I said, they won't even work. When you raise capital gains tax rates to that level, people don't sell appreciated assets. You're way above the level which is actually what's called the revenue maximizing level for capital gains and for the financial transactions tax. Sanders has almost no economic staff. He's got one employee. None of this stuff was run by economists. It doesn't stand up. We just had four Democratic chairs of the Council of Economic Advisors say that the projections that have been made for Sanders are completely ridiculous. This is not stuff that really stands up to scrutiny. There's another just set of macro objections to what – and again, you have to look at the program as a whole. You have to not take one piece at a time.
One moment, Jonathan.
Look at the sum of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
you have to look at the sum of it and the degree, of centralization of power.
Hey, Jonathan, stand by 1 second. Jonathan, I'll come right to you. Please stand by 1 minute. Yes, Paul?
Yeah. You got to look at the degree of centralization of power that all of this implies. And I think it's particularly true in the case of the health plan. Single payer means that Congress is the single decider about the allocation of resources in healthcare. There is a concentration of political power implicit in that health plan, which I think most of the people don't really fully grasp as to this is a plan that eliminates all patient cost sharing, eliminates any other checkpoint on costs. Patients, providers, employers, states have no reason to control healthcare costs. Only the federal government would have a reason to control costs. Consequently, the federal government would have to step in and would have to regulate the whole healthcare system very, very tightly.
Jonathan Tessini, do you see a centralization of power implicit here, and is that all right by you?
Well, of course not, but to the extent that the federal government would manage healthcare, that would be a whole lot better than the insurance companies who are basically and the drug companies who are ripping off Americans, and more important, ripping off our economy, which spends far more as a share of GDP than most country, than any industrialized country in the world. Let me, Paul often cites Kenneth Thorpe, who has been completely discredited in terms of analysis. Once he, back in 2003 and 2005, he actually said in his own analysis then, he projected large savings would recover. Now he's changed his position without actually acknowledging it.
I'll go
through those in a minute where he is absolutely wrong. But I want to focus for a second on the other thing that was brought up, which is these, because it's attracted a lot of public attention, that the chairs, that four chairs of the CEA came out and criticized particularly an analysis that was done by Gerald Freeman, an actual economist, not a public policy.
At University of Massachusetts Amherst, yes.
Correct, an actual economist. Now, a couple of things need to be said. First of all, two of those four chairs work for hedge funds, and one has to question whether Laura Tyson and Austin Goolsbee are actual disinterested parties. All four of them support Hillary Clinton. The more important thing was that when you actually read the letter, and this was astonishing, and a whole bunch of economists, including Jamie Galbraith, have jumped on this, they basically out of hand said the 5.3% growth,
which is what he's predicting.
Well, it evens out. It was just outrageous. But you know what? For economists, they didn't footnote that. They didn't show their analysis. They simply just stated it. And actually, when you go and look at Gerald Friedman's study, and when you go through it, his analysis was pretty orthodox analysis that's used by the OMB, by the CBO, and a whole lot of mainstream people. All he did was take the Sanders proposals, run them through pretty typical models, and he came up with those figures. And it's important to note that Gerald Friedman says he supports Hillary Clinton. So the notion that somehow it didn't add up was just false.
Paul Starr, 5.3% growth, and high growth is necessary here. It may be necessary in almost all the plans that are out there to get us out of the hole we're in. Bernie Sanders counts on it. He's got his economist who says it can happen. What about it? Paul?
So long-term growth, there is basically no support for this from economic history, from a responsible economic analysis, that you can get long-term growth up to 5.3%.
That's wrong. That's just wrong.
Well, you know how rare it is, Jonathan.
There has never been a decade in American history where we've actually averaged 5.3% growth. This is so completely out of line with what – and really here, for example – take a look at what Thomas Piketty says about growth rates, but what the economist Robert Gordon is now writing about long-term growth rates. We're going to be lucky if we can get long-term growth rates up at an average to 2 to 3%. Now, in a short term, you can get a boost from stimulus spending and so forth. But can you maintain that growth rate at that kind of level? Nobody thinks.
What about Jonathan says?
Tom, that's not true.
Okay.
The CBO actually said, as of January 5th, they were projecting 4.5% real GDP growth just into 2016-2017, and that was with not the kind of stimulus that we're suggesting, but a regular growth pattern. The real issue is that that we have this huge gap that was never recovered from what we would call the Great Recession. There's huge capacity that can be filled, and government stimulus can play a big role in that. You can have huge growth rates. It is a question of injecting money and how active you want the government to be. Now, you can have a disagreement about whether the government should do that, whether we should invest $1 trillion or $2 trillion in infrastructure. You can have a disagreement about that. It can be done. That comes down, frankly, and I think that's why it's an important, maybe not a thing to get to right now, but at some point we have to talk about the politics. I totally agree that the political challenge is a huge one. And whether you can get to that growth level, there's a huge block to that politically from, obviously Republicans are not in favor of that. And that's really the fundamental question.
We're looking.
No, I don't think that is the fundamental question for Democrats.
Well, okay, we disagree. That's fine.
I think the program is a political fantasy. There's no way it could be enacted. Actually, it couldn't be enacted with a Democratic Congress.
So let's talk
Congress
about that.
Because you couldn't get the 11 different tax increases.
It's a spectacular list
of tax increases. Well, it's going to be an incredible albatross for the Democratic Party to run with a candidate who's advocating all these taxes.
We disagree about the economics of it. You're not an economist. I'm not an economist. So the economist I read and have talked to also and read stuff in the Financial Times and in many, many different kinds of places say it's totally possible. I do think the politics are very challenging.
Jonathan Tessini, we'll come to that. Please stand by one moment. We're talking about the Bernie Sanders candidacy and the Democratic debate over that candidacy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me slip our callers in here and I'll come right back to the two of you, Jim in Cleveland, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I mean, as far as a 5.3% growth rate, I don't think there's any reason to believe that that could happen. But I would say in combating what the gentleman from the American Prospect is saying, I mean, he's going with this capital gains rate because it's a starting point. He knows he's not going to get that. So, I mean, he knows it's going to have to be some sort of happy medium between what he proposes and what he gets pushback on. So, I mean, if you think he thinks that he's going to get that, he knows he's not going to get that. That's A. B, we need Bernie Sanders, okay, because if we wait for Clinton at all to start proposing some of these big ideas that the other gentleman was talking about, we're never going to get them. We're never going to get someone to kind of infuse this into the conversation. And I would say also about the socialism thing, I mean, John Nichols wrote a book called The S Word, which I would suggest you read, where he quotes Newt Gingrich saying, even more disturbing than the threats from foreign terrorists is the idea of socialism being infused into our dialogue. So really, socialism is not a bad word. And also, I would say, you know, Bernie Sanders, he represents these kinds of ideas that we need to be talking about. And as far as quoting the Council on
Economic Advisors,
the Council on Economic Advisors, I mean, look, as the other gentleman said, those guys are in the bag for the Clinton, Biden, Obama Institute.
Jim, let us pick it up right there. I want to use our time, and I appreciate your call. Paul Starr, the heart of that is, okay, may not agree with everything Bernie Sanders says, but you won't break the status quo without him. That seems to be a big motivator for a lot of supporters.
Well, actually, since this example of the capital gains tax is at the heart of this, the discussion, over the past years when Obama has been president, he's raised the capital gains tax from 15 to 23.8%. There has been progress. And I think if you look at what has happened over the last half century, and I mentioned this in my article in the American Prospect, what you see is that under Democratic administrations, there has been progress in reducing inequality.
But our overall drift has brought us to the Gilded Age, as you say.
Yeah,
we need more. We need more, and we need more from politicians who know how to do things, who know how to get the system to work. And Bernie Sanders has been an outsider. That's the title of his autobiography. He's an outsider in Congress. He has very little to work with in terms of alliances, coalitions, and the idea that this is going to come from a political revolution, but from people going into the streets and demanding it, that's just not going to happen. You've got to be able actually to get things through Congress and to get things done. And
Stand by, Paul. Jonathan, half a minute before the break, but take one swing at that.
Well, so if we were to believe that, then nothing would have changed in America because people would all stand around and say it would be fantasy to think that we would have marriage equality, that there would be actual civil rights for African Americans. If Paul Starr was whispering in the ears of people over the last 20, 30 decades, we'd still have segregation in this country and we'd still have people who couldn't marry the person they'd love. It takes some imagination and it does take organizing the streets, something that many of us have done for many years.
Of course, a lot of mainstream Democrats work for the things that you just cited as well. But point taken. Jonathan Tessini, please stand by in San Francisco. Paul Starr in Princeton, New Jersey. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about the Democrats' debate over Bernie Sanders. Next week, we'll look at Donald Trump and the Republicans. But today, as we head right towards South Carolina and Super Tuesday, it's sort of crunch time. We're talking with Paul Starr. He's at Princeton University, says the Gilded Age needs to end. Politics needs to reassert itself over economics. But he's not for Bernie Sanders. Jonathan Tassini very much is. He's with us from San Francisco, labor organizer, political strategist. He's out around the country speaking on behalf of Bernie Sanders, author of The Essential Bernie Sanders and His Vision for America. You can link to Paul Starr's work and Jonathan Tassini's work at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us. Here's Sanders on education, higher education.
Every kid in this country who has the ability should get a tuition-free going to a public college or university if that's their choice. I'm going to pay for that through a tax on Wall Street speculation. When Wall Street collapsed because of their greed, you know what? You bailed them out. Now I think maybe it's time for Wall Street to help the middle class.
There, Bernie Sanders says free public education. Jonathan Tassini, that's been very popular. We've got listeners, lots of them online in support of Bernie Sanders, others saying, wait a minute, if you tax Wall Street for everything, will they just leave the country? They'll go somewhere else, people are saying here, Jonathan.
Well, it's not true, actually, because there are, as I cited earlier, there are financial taxes around the world being considered, particularly in the EU, and they've been pretty effective. The one that Bernie is suggesting is one that's both been proposed by Dean Baker, an actual economist from the Center for Economic Economic Research. And it's closer to the UK financial transfer tax. You know, look, we sort of get lost in a little bit in the rhetoric about some of these taxes to realize that, particularly in America, people have done quite well, billionaires. And one of my favorite quotes.
I don't think anybody's lost on that point, actually.
Yeah. Well, no,
yeah, can we focus on the question?
When we talk about the financial transactions tax, it's totally doable, and it's been shown actually to work quite well. And it would raise roughly, depending on how much you would see the actual rate of transactions drop, it would actually raise up to $300 billion. Bernie only needs about $75 billion for the free tuition. So I think it's very doable. And I think Dean Baker and others, economists, have found it to be quite reasonable.
Paul Starr, the education plan works, and the capital won't flee. They'll be taxed anywhere they go.
No, I don't think that's at all true. The financial transactions tax that we now have generates about $1 billion. It funds the Securities and Exchange Commission. So Sanders is saying 75
billion. But you
agree
it's quite small. It's quite small.
It is small, and we could raise it some. But that implies raising it by making it 75 times larger than it is. That would be quite a bit higher than any other financial transactions tax. And then you have to ask, well, how will markets respond? How will traders respond? And many of them will respond, first of all, by changing the nature of their transactions. They will make bets in other ways that are not subject to the financial transactions tax, and they will move transactions to markets where those taxes don't apply. That is going to reduce the revenue that you get out of the tax.
And the calculations.
And you're going to have to raise the tax higher and higher to get the revenue that you want.
The calculations that have been done anticipate Robert Pollan has done this in Massachusetts. He's estimated and done calculations based on the rate of transactions falling about even 50%. And it still raises significant money because they deal with bonds, futures, options, interest rate swaps. So it's a much broader a portfolio of what they address. So yes, you're right. There would be some drop, but it still would pay for it.
Paul, you make this case that socialism has has dampened economic growth, or did in its classic formation in other experiments and trials around the world. You fear the same thing would happen here: more centralized government and less growth. Sanders says, "No, not me, not this time, not here, not now. And if and anyway, we need it."
Yeah, the successful social democracies have all adjusted to the realities of a global capitalist system.
Wouldn't Bernie Sanders too?
Well, no. I mean, look at his trade policies. The Scandinavian countries are all open trade. The European Union is in fact a free market. They have had to adjust. In some ways they didn't like to, but they've had to adjust. Sanders hasn't really made that adjustment on either the trade policies or the tax policies. And generally, if you listen to him, his only issue is equality. He doesn't talk about growth really.
He doesn't really have a program that would support the
kind of innovation that the American economy depends on.
That's nonsense. Paul threw in the issue of trade, and it is instructive to me that Hillary Clinton, since we want to bring in some of the politics to it, Hillary Clinton has magically, even though she opposed all these terrible trade agreements we've had so far, has now magically come out and said she opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement. And she only did it partly.
You mean she supported the trade agreements in the past?
She supported it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did I say opposed? Yeah. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. My apologies. She supported all those trade agreements along the way and now has come out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. No one is against trade. That's just a fallacy that people throw out. And Bernie Sanders is not against trade. No one who has opposed those NAFTA-style deals that Bill Clinton rammed through and that Hillary Clinton supported all along the way, no one has been against trade. What we wanted to say was, what are the terms of those trades? Now, I actually have read NAFTA, and I've read those trades agreements because I worked on the trade issue for a long time. They're big, big books, and they have nothing to do with what we call, in the classic sense, that David Ricardo talked about when he talked about free trade. They have to do with all about protecting intellectual property, protecting corporate rights, and then they kind of slap on the side these sort of side agreements about labor and environment. And the things that people have been concerned about is that we don't want, and it's not just in the U.S., people all around the world don't want to give trade, essentially for the trade agreements to be a weapon for corporations basically lower standards. That's the simple difference. And Hillary Clinton, in the face of that, being a longtime free trader, has now said she's opposing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I think that's partly because of politics. But let's be very clear that this isn't about no trade versus trade.
Paul, do you buy that? Or can you have both the kind of labor side agreements and environmental side agreements that Jonathan would like, Bernie Sanders might like, and have robust free trade?
I would like to have stronger side agreements on labor and the environment. They're very tough to get and to enforce. I also agree the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal is not worth approving. It doesn't have enough benefits to American workers. So I don't have a real disagreement here on this. The larger point I was trying to make is that Sanders really stands in a tradition here. And I think I broke a taboo in the article in Politico, mm-hmm. by talking about Sanders' whole history, where he comes from. In 1980, he was a presidential elector for the Socialist Workers Party, which at that time called for the nationalization of industry, which called for the abolition of the military budget, and which at that time expressed solidarity with the regime in Iran, which was holding U.S. hostages.
It was actually just a shameless red-baiting article, which is kind of just...
This is true. Sanders has never at any point said he repudiated what he did in the past.
May I put a question, Paul? So your point with that is that that's not politically saleable today? There's a lot of supporters for him out there right now, or that it will run into trouble against Republicans? What are you saying, Paul?
Well, it is those things, certainly, but it is the tradition that he comes from. It's the intellectual framework that he brings in thinking about problems, and it is fundamentally different from the liberal framework that has predominated in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And really, that is the key thing. That's why if you look at the economic proposals, and again, you have to add up all the different taxes that he's proposed, yeah. and you look at that as a whole, you say that's not consistent with what the Democratic Party has stood for, with what it's offered voters, with how it's seen as economic growth take place. And when we've looked at programs like that in the past, socialist programs elsewhere, they haven't worked
but
well.
But voters might look around and say, look where this has left us, Paul. We had the Clintons. We had Bill Clinton in there for two terms. And then we had everything in the years since. And we've got this tremendous inequality. They may look at exactly what you're describing, Paul, and say, well, the conventional Democratic playbook has not served strongly enough.
Well, hold it. Under Clinton, the economy did very well.
The economy did
and
well.
Let's look at what happened in the last 8 years. Let's just remember what the economy was like when Barack Obama took office.
I do.
And you have to look at the recovery in the U.S. versus the recovery in other countries, including, by the way, the social democracies. The U.S. has actually performed very well under incredibly difficult circumstances. So this is not a record that Democrats have to be ashamed of.
Jonathan Tessini, do you have a problem with Paul bringing up Bernie's history? I mean, he's proud of his own history.
No, but there's a few things that were just thrown in here that need to be addressed. The first thing is that the kind of incremental liberalism that Paul represents has failed miserably. And if the comparison is to what the Republicans have done, that's a pretty narrow window to think about. And it's the reason that millions of people are angry with both parties, because forget about the Republicans. Let's agree that they're kind of a clown car. But if you look at the Bill Clinton administration, it was built mostly in a credit bubble. Bill Clinton was the person who removed Glass-Steagall at the behest of the bankers, which essentially led, or was part of the reason that led to the collapse of the financial greed.
It had absolutely nothing to do with it.
You got to filibuster with your red baiting. Let me finish. And then he then pushed through NAFTA, which essentially obliterated millions of good-paying jobs, particularly for African-Americans and Latinos across the country, and particularly in the industrial Midwest. Now, Bernie, we're going to go back and forth about this. I think it was a shameless piece of red baiting that Paul wrote, and frankly, it's embarrassing, but if he's proud of that, that's fine. Let's talk about Bernie Sanders. What he wants to do, let's talk about right today. I'm happy to talk about history, but today he's offering democratic socialism, and he's very concrete about it, and I think in a very American way. He's saying that every person who wants to go to college, we should allow them to do that tuition-free. It's one of the reasons that many young people who are burdened by hundreds of thousands of debt think it's a good thing, and he pays for it very clearly. He says that, like every industrialized country in the world, we should have free healthcare from cradle to grave, and we should stop the ripoff of insurance companies and drug companies. Every American, at least most Americans who are not in universities and get full health coverage and are among the 1%, every American understands that that needs to be done. And you go down all the things that he's proposing. They're very American proposals. Now, can he get them through? Is there huge political opposition? Absolutely. And I think that will be the biggest challenge when he is president. And as I look at it,
Jonathan Stanbaugh, I have to say right here, we're talking about the debate over Bernie Sanders' candidacy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sorry, Jonathan. Yep.
I'm sorry?
Yes, please go ahead.
I do think that this is a 10-year project. And I can get very specific about that, what that means, how you target people in midterm elections, how you build a movement, the fact that Bernie has built this huge well of small contributors who can actually finance campaigns after he's elected president. There is actually the budding of a real movement here that's not just about electing him president. But I don't disagree, and maybe Paul and I can find one point of agreement here. I don't disagree that this is a huge challenge to try to push things forward, even on the points of agreement that we might have. There's huge obstacles to that. And I think that's kind of an interesting challenge that, you know, we'll see what happens.
Paul, is this the right rallying point? You say no, why not?
Okay. Think through the consequences of free public college tuition. It sounds great. Absolutely. But what's to stop that tuition from going up and up? Well, obviously, somebody has to regulate that. If the federal government has guaranteed it, then federal government's going to have to regulate college finance. It's going to have to regulate Okay.
I mean,
okay.
Well,
that's okay. Let's answer that question, Paul. No, answer that. No, it's a legitimate question.
The government regulates. The government regulates the military. We have a huge Pentagon budget, and you can I actually happen to disagree about how that money is spent. It's not as if the government doesn't regulate.
Paul, what do you say to this? So what? I mean, it's a simple question in a way. There's more power there, and Jonathan says, "So what?" And you respond, "How, Paul?"
I'm concerned when you have these wonderful things, free health care, free tuition, that indeed there has to be control. That control has to come from Washington. And so you're talking about not just increasing the size of the federal government by about 40 to 50%, but also increasing the amount of power centered in Washington. Now, Sanders says he's running against the political establishment, but the political establishment's going to stay there. It's not going to go away. So actually, it's going to accrue. The power of the central of that establishment is going to grow as a result of that.
That's not true. I don't actually have a lack of faith in government per se. I have a lack of faith in a government that's controlled by lobbyists, particularly by the Clinton form of government, if you will. They actually raise it to an art form in the way of letting lobbyists run Congress, as Bernie likes to say. The point, and I think the threat that people feel in the Democratic Party, is they know that when Bernie Sanders is elected, he is going to take on lobbyists and he is going to try to rid that corruption that is endemic. Every American knows this, that Congress is bought and paid for by lobbyists. And Bernie has been very clear that he's going to clean up. First of all, and frankly, forget the Republicans, Paul. The Democratic Party is going to be the first challenge for Bernie because they are so wrapped up in that lobbyist culture that we have to, first of all, defeat that in the Democratic Party before we actually get to the question, understandably, of the immovable block of the Republican Party.
Paul,
I listened to this, and I think it almost requires a basic lesson in how American government works. Presidents don't have the power to do all these things by themselves.
Paul Starr says,
I'm sure you can learn that in Princeton, in the hallowed halls of Princeton. That's where you'd learn how to.
It's hot out there. We will know a lot more about where this may go after South Carolina and after Super Tuesday. It is tough to keep it all on the beam, but these are exactly the arguments and the emotions that are running through Democratic kitchen debates all over the country right now. And I'm glad to hear them right here today. Jonathan Tessini, labor organizer, strategist, Bernie Sanders supporter in San Francisco today. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure.
Paul Starr, professor at Princeton University. You can read his pieces at our website, onpointradio.org. Professor Starr, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.